Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and legal procedures and break them down into everyday terms for just regular people. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. As President Trump's Department of Justice continues to target his political enemies, the topic of vindictive prosecutions is in the news. But what does that term really mean? Well, today we'll delve into the topic and try to make that concept understandable for everyone and bring it up to date with some of today's headlines. Judge Gail, let me just start off with the concept of vindictive prosecutions. It's sort of a concept that flies below the radar until now, because you don't hear of them very often. There's not much case law about them. But basically, it means that to claim vindictive prosecution, you must show as a defendant that the prosecution harbored, quote, genuine animus toward the defendant, and they could not have been prosecuted except for that. That's a quick and dirty definition. Vindictive prosecution claims must show that prosecutors harbored genuine animus toward them and that they would not have been prosecuted except for that. Now, we have several cases on the horizon. We have the James Comey case. We have the Letitia James case in New York. We have the John Bolton case coming up in Washington. We hear the term swirling around all of those cases, but boy, it is bullseye right on with the James Comey case.
At least it appears to be. And, you know, one thing I just want to add as a caveat, if you will, to your definition of vindictive prosecution are also some important elements to consider, meaning there's the topic or the even the concept of vindictiveness kind of screams another word we're familiar with, which is retaliation. And so part of the animus also means that there's some element there of retaliation that the defendant believes they are being retaliated against. And more often and generally in the legal realm, it's for exercising an existing or a legal right. And they are very, very difficult cases to prove. The burden largely rests with the defendant because the defendant raises the issue or the motion, which means they then generally have to defend it. Essentially, there's one point in the proceedings where the prosecution need only respond to it, but once they respond, the burden, the huge burden, really shifts to the defendant to prove that the prosecution was actually retaliatory in nature. And you are absolutely right in that there's just very scant, very little case law in this area because they have more often than not been unsuccessful for a defendant. These have been very unsuccessful cases and defenses historically, and courts and judges have, by and large, kind of accepted the notion that prosecutors wear the white hats, if you will, that they come with clean hands, that they are legitimately, genuinely investigating and prosecuting cases appropriately, and that although there can be some tangential or faint argument made about why perhaps the defendant's feelings are hurt because they've been prosecuted, kind of bounding that high bar of vindictiveness, showing animus or hate or complete complete disrespect or disregard has been traditionally a very high bar to meet and has largely been met with lack of success for a lot of defendants. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a very difficult hill to climb in normal circumstances.
In normal. I should have perhaps said that as a caveat as well.
However, right now, it seems like we're not in normal circumstances. So let's take the case of James Comey, the former FBI director, who's charged with a couple felony counts of lying to Congress. That's what the indictment is for. He's attacking this case on multiple levels, all under the umbrella of vindictiveness. So let's try to parse these out a little bit, and let's start with one of the easier ones, Judge Gale, and that is James Comey and Letitia James, the Attorney General of the state of New York, combined to file a motion in federal court arguing that the prosecutor, handpicked by President Trump and thrown into the fray by Attorney General Pam Bondi,
with no prior prosecutorial experience. Can we please say that enough for our audience?
Her name's Lindsay Halligan. She has no prior prosecution experience. She was a real estate lawyer and one who represented the Trump Organization in some civil real estate matters. Basically, the argument there, as I understand it, Judge, is that they're seeking a dismissal saying that the prosecutor was not properly appointed, was illegally appointed, and so therefore everything that prosecutor did, everything Ms. Halligan did, was wrong and should be thrown out, including the indictments against both Letitia James and James Comey. Do I have it right?
You have it absolutely right. And what I'd like for our audience to understand is the underpinnings of this improper appointment kind of rests with the requirement of advice and consent of the Senate, which was not received for Ms. Halligan. And quite frankly, this same argument has been successful in at least three other circumstances. If you look to New Jersey, the district attorney that was appointed in New Jersey has been removed. The same has happened in Nevada, and I believe the third was in New Mexico. There have been at least three other instances, separate and apart from Ms. Halligan, where this argument has actually been successful. And what it does is it jeopardizes the legitimacy of any work these attorneys have done. I won't call them prosecutors, given that the court has ruled that they were improperly appointed in those instances. If this court follows suit with what has happened now three times in three different jurisdictions across this country, then, you know, not only are these two cases, meaning the Comey and the James cases, now, you know, in line with those that have come out of those three jurisdictions, and we can now question the validity of the work or indictments out of those cases, it really does tend to, you know, if this were a sheet of ice, it actually takes a hammer to it and certainly, you know, puts some cracks in that sheet of ice, making, you know, standing on these indictments a little more shaky. Well, that fact alone.
If I understand it, that motion for vindictive prosecution because of illegal prosecution was filed in New York. Is that correct?
It was.
And, you know, so. So if we look at the James Comey case, we've got a New York federal judge deciding whether the prosecutor was legal. And then we shift geography down to Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, where we have two situations going on. We have the Comey defense team claiming that there were errors in the way that the indictment was reached by Halligan. And I'm not talking about the grand jury of faux pas now. I'm talking about the magistrate went back and really looked in depth and thought that in getting the indictment, the FBI may have conducted themselves improperly, that the prosecutor's office and the attorney general were guilty of misconduct, and it went so far, Judge, as the magistrate ordering that all of the materials presented to the grand jury be presented to the defense. That's really strong.
It is so strong. And I think what our listeners should understand is that these are the absolute definition of anomalies, right? These do not happen.
You're right.
What you've just described is often requested. So let's be really clear. It is not uncommon for a defense team, whether, you know, you have the high powered defense team that, you know, I would, you know, in my day, I would call them the squadron. And so if you get the squadron that is, you know, very prepared to zealously advocate for the defendant, it is not uncommon for them to request grand jury transcripts, grand jury proceedings. However, traditionally, courts, and I'm sure you've received these requests as much as I've responded to them when I was a prosecutor, that courts have been very, very careful to protect the secrecy and the nature of grand jury proceedings, in large part because the threshold is so low, right? Probable cause. Was a crime committed? Is this person likely the person that's committed the crime? There's lots of daylight.
Sometimes it's a way to bring in a witness secretly.
Indeed.
That you wouldn't produce at trial.
Yeah, or to continue an investigation.
Yeah.
So the proceedings are by their very nature not open to the public. Defendants generally do not testify at the grand jury, although it is not uncommon or it's not impossible for a defendant to testify at the grand jury. It's just uncommon.
My whole career, I had one defendant testify to the grand jury. And I sweated the whole time.
Right? So, you know, really sweating bullets because you're like,
that's right.
Do not say, because right. There's a record. There's a court reporter.
And really, it's under oath.
It's under oath. The only people really in the room are the grand jurors, the prosecutor, the court reporter, and the witness or the witnesses that may be brought in, which frequently are not a lot, right? There may not be a lot of witnesses in presenting just, again, what's often very basic, scant information.
Sometimes
to a grand
jury. Sometimes they just bring in a law enforcement officer, just one.
And it may be one. And the presentation may only be minutes. It's not days or it's not hours. It's not weeks. It may be just a few minutes and an indictment can be returned. And so you're absolutely right when, you know, what we've seen traditionally is courts have been very willing to protect the process. They understand it. Judges are not very easily swayed to lift the veil, if you will, from the grand jury process or the proceedings and to provide access to the defense for this. So you're right. Again, this is just a textbook case of anomalies because to have a magistrate judge say there are profound irregularities and missteps that are so pronounced and patently obvious to the court that the appropriate thing, the just thing to do is to provide the defense access to all of these grand jury records is actually thunder striking. And to know, and I think all of us should have expected it, right? Because from this administration, they're very, very prone to appeal anything that they may not particularly care for. So that our listeners understand, because the original order was issued by the magistrate judge actually responds or is accountable to the trial judge. And so once the magistrate judge entered the order, ordering the government to turn these grand jury records over to the defense, their natural response was to appeal, but not the kind of appeal that we've talked about in prior episodes.
No, it doesn't go to a three-judge panel.
Correct.
Or up to the circuit. It's an appeal to
the trial judge.
The trial judge, mm-hmm. who the magistrate reports to.
Correct. And that's why the proceedings, the more recent proceedings that have taken place, were in front of the trial judge that not only the magistrate judge reports to, but is the trial judge that is, you know, assigned to this case. And trial judges can assign parts of the case to magistrate judges to handle. And that's what happened in this instance, so that everyone understands we're not removing to another court or to an appellate court. What happened was the order of the magistrate judge was removed to the trial judge. And of course, if there's a dislike with that, then that's when you go to the appellate court.
Okay, so let's get back to the Comey case. The magistrate wrote a blistering report of all of the defects in the process. And at that point, Comey also pointed out that the President of the United States, President Trump, ordered his attorney general to get this indictment and did that publicly through his Truth Social account.
Which was supposedly by accident. It was supposed to be a private exchange.
Was supposed to be a private text, but it ended up being a public post. However,
folks, watch the aging people in your life. Please look out for them.
Yeah. And then what happens is the magistrate writes this blistering opinion, orders the grand jury, all the grand jury material to be presented to the defense. As you said, the appeal then goes to the judge, Judge Michael Nachmanoff. And what he did is he just put a hold on what the magistrate did and said, okay, we're going to have a hearing on this and we're going to thrash all of this out. And we're going to do that really quickly. And we're recording this on Thursday morning, November 20th. That hearing occurred yesterday on November 19th. And the judge heard argument on all of the materials that we've just talked about. However, the judge also discovered something new and something that may end up being fatal.
I think my eyebrows are in a permanent state of shock with this case.
Are they raised or are they raised or furrowed?
And let's talk a little bit about what was discovered during the hearing with the magistrate. The magistrate, in his very blistering opinion, indicated that there may have been violations of the defendant's due process rights, with the prosecution at least suggesting that the defendant must testify, which is completely inappropriate and incorrect. It's a violation of a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. He also indicated in that blistering opinion that the agents who investigated this matter may have disclosed information that was protected by attorney-client privilege and should not have been provided, released to, or otherwise disclosed to the grand jurors.
This is the magistrate.
Indeed. And so when the judge, the trial judge, essentially said, okay, listen, you know, let's put a hold on this order. All the kids in the pool, we're going to see you here in the courtroom on the 19th. We're going to flesh this out. What I suspect the judge was planning to focus on was, yes, the issue of vindictive prosecution vis-a-vis the Truth Social post and tying that to the prosecution, because I think that was indeed the defense's plan, was to directly tie that to the actions of the prosecutors and say they followed instructions when the prosecutor's arguments was, hey, Lindsey Halligan has no personal animus against James Comey. She doesn't dislike him personally. She's doing her job. Her job was to present this case. She presented it. The grand jury returned an indictment. However, what was learned yesterday was that the very indictment that has been presented to the court, or should I say courts, to the magistrate judge as well as to the trial judge, does not now appear to be a charging instrument. That's what an indictment is, a charging instrument. It is designed to lay out the actual charges that the grand jury intend to return through the indictment. That charging instrument or that indictment was apparently never presented to the grand jurors as a whole, as it was.
Okay, let me break this down a little bit further, and, mm-hmm. and then you can go on. The prosecution tried to get three counts, three felonies, three charges against Comey. They took it to the grand jury. And the grand jury, you know, in they may have misstepped in how they took it to the grand jury. But on this point alone, they took it to the grand jury and the grand jury said, no, we're not going to do one of the three. So the prosecution then went back, redid the indictment to only have two felonies. Did not present it to the whole grand jury, but instead just had the foreperson of the grand jury sign it. Well, my reading is that's against federal law. Is that your reading as well?
Indeed. And this is kind of grand jury presentation 101. When presenting information or evidence to a grand jury, it is important that the grand jurors who you are expecting to vote upon returning this indictment, it's important that they all understand what charges are being requested by the prosecution and what charges they are willing to support with their vote by returning the indictment. By presenting them with one document that contains, now I want everyone to be clear, understand that a single indictment or a single charging instrument can and often does contain multiple or more than one charges. You can have
right. They're called counts.
Counts.
Yes. Different counts, which are different crimes, all under one document called an indictment.
Precisely. And so the first indictment that was pre-drafted and contained three counts or three criminal charges was the one the entire grand jury was apparently privy to. And upon deliberation, the grand jury decided to not Trubill or vote in favor of at least one of the three charges. Now, I am not clear how the prosecution came to know which of those three charges was not approved by the grand jury.
But I think the grand jury told them in some form.
Yes.
It was clear that they knew.
Indeed. So suffice it to say, the prosecution became very aware that at least one of the three charges in the original charging document that had been pre-constructed for the grand jury, that they declined to indict on one of those charges. That means that the prosecution then was left perhaps with the remaining two charges. As opposed to redrafting the charging document and returning it to the full grand jury for further deliberation or to start the process over, because that's what should happen, is the process should begin again. Instead of doing that, it became apparent through testimony yesterday in open court that instead the prosecutor led by Ms. Halligan, who's, again, never done this before, merely amended, cut and paste the original document to pare away, excise out, take away the one charge that the grand jury indicated they declined, leaving intact two other charges, and merely in the presence of the grand jury foreperson and maybe one other person signed that document. And then the kicker was that both of those documents, both the original one, which with the three charges, which by the way, Ms. Halligan had apparently signed that as well, both of that one and the indictment with the two charges were presented to a judge, to a different magistrate judge, regarding this case, which confused the very first magistrate judge who saw this, that saw one indictment with three charges and a signature, and a second indictment for the same individual, same course of conduct, same allegations, but it had two charges signed also by the prosecutor. This is just stunning. It's stunning to be this, to have these kinds of missteps.
It's not missteps, it's ineptitude.
It's shocking.
So let's make this clear for our listeners. These all sound like administrative things, ministerial things, things that probably shouldn't matter. And in most cases, they wouldn't. In other words, the prosecution could go back to a grand jury and correct all of these mistakes and then bring back a clean indictment.
Or maybe the prosecution would not have rushed, seemingly, to do this in the first place.
However, in this case, the government was up against what's called a statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. That says you can only bring criminal charges against a defendant within a specific period of time, whether it's 6 months, a year, 6 years, whatever the case may be. It's a finite period of time.
And I believe this one was 5 years.
This was right up against that 5-year deadline. Mm-hmm. And so, now, to have the indictments, if the judge decides the indictments are fatally flawed, that means the prosecution cannot go back to the grand jury because of the statute of limitations. Now, do I have that right?
Generally speaking, yes. What I will say is that I can anticipate that in the event that these indictments are determined to be fatally flawed on the procedural steps that we've just outlined, we haven't even really discussed some of the substance of the vindictive prosecution, which is at the heart of the defense's motion, in essence, of vindictive prosecution. I suspect you'll have the prosecutors that will appeal at least the time frame, because it seems that there is not a lot of argument. At least they seem to concede that these were just administrative errors. This is just a mix-up in paperwork. This isn't something that can't be cured.
The DOJ, Pam Bondi, Lindsay Halligan both admitted that this was an error.
Yeah, these are errors, but they're administrative. They are not fatal. We can fix these. And I suspect the argument will be that even if the court decides to dismiss these cases, even if the court dismissed them with prejudice, the prosecution is going to argue that they should not be dismissed with prejudice, meaning a complete bar to bringing the case back to the grand jury. They're going to ask for a dismissal without prejudice and argue that for some reason, under the circumstances, they should be permitted a reasonable amount of time to cure the defects, meaning to fix the problem. Now, generally,
this would go to the D.C. Circuit,
indeed,
which is not really prone to be pro-Trump administration normally.
But the U.S. Supreme Court is perceived to be that, and they would try to get it to that level. As you can see, I think that has been kind of the legal gameplay for this administration, which is this will take time, but anything we don't like, just get it to the Supreme Court, and it will be fixed there. We'll get what we want at the Supreme Court. Now, again, that sort of suggests that this court will grant certiorari for any and everything that comes out of this administration. And I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if this court will grow weary of, you know, frequently having to insert itself into matters that were it not involving this administration, they would likely not even entertain. But I guess time will tell, but I can certainly see the prosecution in this case. I could see the government arguing to hold on to just, you know, a few more days a few more days to represent. But remember, and you know this as a former defense attorney, the speedy trial clock waits for no man. And yeah, so you will have a defense that says, you know, that's fine. You re-indicted. You better be ready to try it tomorrow, because we're not waiving anything. We're not asking for any more discovery. We're not doing any. We are ready to take our chances with what we have, because we think your case is just that weak. And that really is, it could result in the ultimate black eye for the U.S. Department of Justice, because we are so accustomed to them just having a more polished practice and right. being more skilled and being far more deliberative. And this just seems to be, you know, the complete antithesis of the reputation that the U.S. Department of Justice has worked to create for itself over generations.
So recognizing that this is a vital aspect of the case, and recognizing that it will probably go to the Court of Appeals and maybe to the Supreme Court, Judge Michael Nachmanoff, who heard the motion yesterday, he has decided to take this under advisement and issue a written decision about this. Normally, these kinds of things, Judge Gale, as you know, are ruled from the bench. You know, they're quick rulings with not a lot behind them, other than the judge may cite a couple of cases as precedent, but they're verbal rulings. Not in this case.
Absolutely.
He's preparing this knowing that it's going to go up to the Court of Appeals and on to the Supreme Court.
Indeed. And he's also, which I think judges do quite frequently, especially when they can kind of see around corners, is they're really trying to create a record that does kind of become appeal proof, right? They don't want the appellate courts, without regard to level, they don't want the appellate courts in any way trying to substitute their judgment for that of the trial judge, or to try to figure out what the trial judge was thinking or doing. And part of the reason, I'll tell you, part of the reason why these decisions are often rendered from the bench and in just very, you know, quick fashion is, as I said earlier, they're often unsuccessful. And so yeah. with the lack of success, is really easy to pronounce from the bench just into the record itself why the court, you know, does not agree with the defendant.
You're just perfunctory. Right.
And why we're moving on, and to reiterate the trial date often, or, you know, to talk about the pretrial schedule and where, and the discovery exchange schedule, and when things have to be complied with. And essentially moving on to the next motion. That is why it often just comes straight from the bench. And again, this is me kind of taking a risk here, trying to peer into the future. And you can tell me what you think about this. I genuinely believe that this is such a unique circumstance. It is riddled with so many errors, and errors from the FBI to the prosecutors to the handling of all of this. I genuinely believe the reason why the trial judge here is going to take the opportunity, which, by the way, the opinion is supposed to be released before Thanksgiving. That's next week. That's right. Next week. I think he's doing it because I think this is going to be one of those rare instances where the defense motion is granted.
Well, not only are we talking about the defect in the grand jury and the final indictment, but we're also talking about the hearing also included all of the other arguments about Trump publicly demanding that he be prosecuted, and that was a vindictive act. All of these other factors are included in this hearing as well. So the judge will be addressing all of those matters in his written decision, which makes even more imperative that he issue a quality written document.
which we've actually seen so much of out of the trial court.
Oh, and the trial courts are doing yeoman work.
They are doing the heavy lifting here. And, you know, I don't know that, and maybe because, you know, we're kind of nerds and we kind of watch this, but I don't know that we've really seen a time when we've seen so many trial judges issue so many multi-page opinions
and
that are
well-researched. Well-reasoned.
Yes, opinions. Well-reasoned, well-researched, very clear in how you really understand the court's logic. And I think part of it is they feel like they're forced to under the circumstances, and that it is so much more necessary now than perhaps ever before. But I really think what's going to happen with this opinion, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've written a few opinions in my time, but I think what the judge here is going to be required to do is a lot of even ifs. Even if, the prosecution survived on this argument, there's this fatality. And even if that was not a fatality, there's this fatality. And so I think this is so cumulative in nature.
The term is totality of the circumstances.
Indeed. Indeed, it is. And it's so, again, I think it's just cumulative. You have so many reasons, any one of them. So if we walk through these, right, if we, you know, the court could hang its hat on giving the grand jury an instruction suggesting that the defendant would testify to clarify things or clear things up, which is absolutely violative of the defendant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Correct.
The court could hang its hat on that alone and just decline to address anything else, which I doubt it will. It will say, even if that is not a fatality, your FBI agent that allegedly disclosed sensitive
privileged
information that was privileged is a fatality, which the court could, you know, rely upon that alone to dismiss this case. The fact that the president issued a missive on a public social media platform, essentially instructing DOJ to proceed with this effort, and in lockstep and shortly thereafter, all of these things took place and an indictment was returned. That is vindictive. They could hang their hat on that. And then they could say, well, and even if any of these things were not fatal, we now get to the point where we have the presentation of multiple charging instruments to the court, one of which the grand jury never saw, which is clearly fatal in this, or at least in my opinion and in my experience, it would clearly be fatal. Now, again, the judge can rule any way he chooses, but I think he's going to do a lot of even ifs in this order.
In that even if, you know, if he goes back and says there was real animus, back to our original definition, mm-hmm, there was real animus against Comey by the powers that be, like the president, you know, that could, he wants to make sure that that is appellate proof as mm-hmm well.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So if the prosecution says, well, this is a I can never say that word, administrative act. There we go. I can't say the other one. As far as the indictment goes, you know, and we can correct that. The judge's opinion may say, but you can't correct these other things.
Indeed.
You know, and try to make his opinion bulletproof to the Court of Appeals.
I think that is absolutely the ultimate goal. And in fact, again, I think what we've read, what we know, what we've heard from yesterday's proceedings, I want to say, and judges, especially federal judges, I think they rarely, you know, get out of what I like to call their hookup, right? They rarely are out of character. It's rare that they can be shocked into, a situation where, you know, they've never seen it before. But I think judges are having the experience more often than not of seeing things they've never seen before. Even when it came to, I believe, an exchange at some point yesterday with one of the prosecutors regarding a declination memo. A declination memo is, as I understand it, a memo produced by the U.S. Department of Justice that outlines
Right.
A declination or declining to prosecute because it's not in the interest of justice is kind of the seeing around the corner, understanding that this case cannot survive the high standard of beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, that there's way either too much in the statute that is unclear, or there are just not enough facts and evidence to support whatever charges the department might seek to bring here. And therefore, in the interest of justice, you decline to prosecute. And what seemed to be discovered yesterday was the prosecutor, that the judge was very, very insistent on learning whether or not that memo had actually been produced.
And who had it?
And where it was? Yes, where it was. And I think also, you know, what underlies that is, you know, how, whether, if at all, the Justice Department gave it any credence, that it, or just was it dismissed outright? And if the dismissal outright of that declination memo was tied to, again, what became the public missive from the administration, which is, I don't really care.
Prosecute.
Yeah, if these things aren't in line, you are instructed right now to prosecute this case, to indict this case, indict this individual. And that is, I think, you know, another point that the judge is not going to let just go by without addressing it, because it is pretty central to how we got in the courtroom in the first place.
The prosecutor in court, though, hemmed and hawed about whether that
it was the quintessential hominy, hominy, hominy.
Exactly. It was the judge with the thumb, and the judge wouldn't let up on that point.
You had to know that that was going to happen, right?
You would think
that they knew. But here's why I think the other failing here, right? When you purge a department that has had career prosecutors in it, they are very well acquainted with the temperament of the judges that they deal with. They know the environment. They know what they're dealing with. And when you essentially purge that and replace that with individuals who are not as skilled or learned or adept, then this is the outcome you're going to get just about 10 times out of 10.
What is interesting with this is we've been talking all of this about Judge Nachmanoff's court in Alexandria, Virginia. All of this could sort of be determined moot if the judge in New York says Lindsey Halligan had no authority to even be in the room of the grand jury, let alone trying to prosecute the case.
I think it could be. But again, I don't think that it would stop the government from appealing. I think it won't stop them from appealing. And therefore, I think from a judicial standpoint, that there is still benefit in issuing a very well-reasoned opinion and decision in this case, if for no other reason than to have another, it's kind of the belt and suspenders approach, right? So if the New York decision ends up getting, you know, falling the way of the other three prosecutors in those three jurisdictions have been, if it falls that way and there's an appeal, then you still have the belt, if you will. If the suspenders fall off, you have the belt that's there in the Virginia trial court that says, okay, so even if the appeals court comes back and says, well, yeah, you know, it might have been a rush, but, you know, she can still stay as the, she can remain as the prosecutor, you still have to deal with the issue of this particular case in this particular instance so many flaws that it cannot go forward. Now, again, that's going to be to the chagrin of a whole lot of other defendants who are actually probably quite frankly hoping that the decision out of New York is consistent with the decision out of those three other jurisdictions. Because guess what? Every defense attorney in those jurisdictions are going to line up and say, hey, this person can't prosecute. She can't prosecute nobody. And that means there's a fatality with my client's indictment. And until you all do it right, my client is now, you know, should now be released and free to proceed with their life. That's what every other defense attorney wants. And rightfully so, because it does taint not just the one case. If the decision out of New York comes down to, hey, you were improperly appointed in the first place, then that is far more sweeping because it doesn't just affect one case. It affects everyone you touched.
Yeah. I do want to say what Judge Makhmanoff ended yesterday's hearing with, according to Newsweek reporter who was in the courtroom. He ended this after saying that he was going to do a written opinion and not issue an opinion from the bench. He had one sentence I thought was perfect. The issues are too wavy and too complex to decide it today. I love that.
Wavy
and too complex. What a neutral way of putting this.
It's a neutral way of, in my view, saying this case has a tail that wags.
Yeah.
This is a dog, and we should not be. We need to untie all these ropes and, you know, pardon the mixed metaphors and analogies, but we got to untie all of this. And I need to do this in a very methodical way. And I need to do this in a way that does not provide, you know, and there's always, you know, somebody who doesn't like the court's ruling. So yeah. A way that will not provide the side that's displeased with the opening, the avenue, the latitude to just come back and say, well, the judge missed this. Because here's what we've been hearing, I think, in a lot of instances, and it just breaks my heart for the judiciary, is that when, at least in this, in recent times, and particularly with this administration, when they've received rulings that they do not agree with, which happens in all kinds of cases. Trust me, we've had these experiences when somebody inevitably walks out the courtroom and they just not happy with the decision or the outcome, but that's still it. But we don't expect, you know, complete backlash toward the judiciary as a whole. And that's what the judiciary has been experiencing. If, you know, when a judge issues a ruling that is to the displeasure of the administration, then it becomes very personal. It becomes very political. It becomes very nonsensical. And it is directed at the judiciary as a whole so as to, in my view, to try to diminish the value and the importance of the judiciary as being a separate co-equal branch of government that has a very specific requirement and responsibility, more so now than ever before.
We're running out of time, but there are a couple of quick points that I'd like to make and maybe get to your last comments on. This case with Comey and the one with Letitia James that are currently in the news really are just, I think, precursors of other things to come. Because right now, there's a grand jury being impaneled in Florida by the U.S. attorney to probe acts of former Obama administration people. There are basically, this grand jury is going to be looking at any enemies of Trump as perhaps political hits. We're looking at possible indictments against Senator Adam Schiff from California, Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House.
Eric Swalwell,
a representative from California. Mm-hmm. So all of these will flow from the court's decisions here in Comey. Comey's first, and all of these will have a ripple effect on all of these other cases, in my view. Do you share that?
I do, but I think we saw that part coming, right? With it regard to these cases that we see, actually, And again, not being a former defense attorney, I am kind of defense focused a lot today, because here's what I also believe will happen is that the outcome of these cases, whether it's New York or in Virginia, that the outcome of these cases is going to provide anyone else similarly situated with a blueprint to respond. And that essentially what's being done in the nature of these cases, I think two things will happen. First, yes, the defense will create essentially a blueprint for responding to vindictive prosecution cases, and that will likely be the through line for most, if not all, of those former or current politicians who will face essentially the wrath of the US DOJ. But I think at the same time, we are taking or maybe taking for granted the wisdom of grand juries, right? I don't know that notwithstanding all of these efforts, because one thing kind of struck me yesterday with the hearing that took place, I think the judge actually, like I said, he kind of got out of his hookup, because at one point, I think he actually referred to Ms. Halligan as a puppet. And that, I think, is very uncommon. And
yes,
that's not kind of the normal vernacular of a judge. But
no,
I think the exasperation and frustration of what was unfolding just kind of led him to say what he was thinking. And that's, you know, again, why I believe the court's opinion will be what it will be. But at the same time, can you imagine how those grand jurors might be feeling duped? And how
anybody else receiving
a subpoena to sit on a federal grand jury may feel like they're now going to be just duped into, you know, participating in this grand scheme that they're not interested in. And
my wife sat on one for a year. She said it was fascinating.
It can be. But that was years ago. But here's what I think we're doing with the public as a whole is we're actually raising skepticism in them when it comes to bringing forward certain cases, right?
Yeah,
they know these names. They know these people. And if we saw it, actually, I think we may have mentioned it in a prior episode. Remember what happened with former Judge Jeanine Pirro in Washington, D.C., who did the end run around the federal grand jury and took the case to the local grand jury to achieve an indictment, much to the surprise and dismay of the judge. That's something terribly uncommon. And so that tells me that that federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. wasn't interested perhaps in being what they felt was duped. I think this was the sandwich guy. And so they're just like,
The sandwich guy found not guilty
by a jury
on a misdemeanor.
And this is after, right. And this is after the federal grand jury refused to indict. They took it to the local grand jury, which was very uncommon. And even the trial. At the trial, because he had a pettit jury at trial, and they were just like, no. So how many thumbs down do you need? How many times do you need somebody to tell you no, no, no? And what I'm concerned about is that we're going to have a general public. And keep in mind, folks, grand jurors are members of the general public. We don't have some special pool of super citizens that we tap to sit on grand juries. These are folks that are listening to this podcast right now who could just as sooner walk to their mailbox today and have a subpoena that summons them to sit on a federal grand jury. And these are the same folks that are listening and ingesting the news each day. And they don't want to be puppets, kind of like what the judge described the prosecutor as. They don't want any parts of that. They want a justice system that actually works for everybody, that is not slanted, because you never know. And we've probably said this to jurors before. You never know when you might need a jury to resolve something for you. So you want the system to be fair. You want it to work the right way because you understand the stakes if you were similarly situated. And I think this is turning it on its head. And what you may have, quite frankly, is revolt by grand jury jurors who are like, no, just we're no-billing everything because we just don't want to be involved in, you know, what looks like a fantastic setup that is not really worthy of the justice system.
Yeah, a plot. Mm-hmm. One last thing, and then we need to wrap it up, and that is John Bolton, the former national security advisor to the president. He's been charged with having high-profile classified documents in his possession that were illegally possessed by him. That case, because it involves documents and statutes, seems a whole lot different from the Letitia James, James Comey cases that we've been talking about. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I don't know that I do. But I agree that substantively there are distinctions based on what the alleged, what the allegations are. But right. I think procedurally, when you're talking about whether or not the prosecutor had the authority to bring the charges, whether or not there's vindictiveness or there's some vindictive motive behind bringing these charges, I think those are defenses that may still survive because he may argue, I was outspoken. I was an outspoken critic. And because I was an outspoken critic, these charges were brought against me and they never would have been brought against me, but for me exercising my legal rights. Now,
would you agree with me though, that as it stands now, he does not have the strong vindictive evidence mm-hmm. that Comey has?
Indeed. I do think there's a distinction. That's why I said, I think substantively, there are certainly some differences that does not put him on the same footing as Mr. Comey and Ms. James, even. I think there's a difference here, but I also think that his defense will kind of use this, like I said, this blueprint. I think they'll use this blueprint to at least try to make the strongest argument that they can for their client. But I also think this goes back to my earlier point, which says, hey, y'all, take care of your aging friends, family, and relatives, because Mr. Bolton ain't a spring chicken. And he probably could have handled this stuff a lot better if somebody hadn't turned him loose on a computer with an AOL account or something. Which I'm
Come on now. AOL's Come on now. You're getting close to the source here. No, I'm substantially older than you. You're getting close to the source here.
But I really think that if somebody keeps an eye on you, you might not do some of this
stuff. So to make sure you don't get in further trouble, how do people listen to us?
Well, we want to invite you guys to please continue to tune in. We're honored to continue to bring Next Witness Please to you on one of our proud partners, NPR. So you can check us out on NPR, Apple, Spotify, and Amazon, or anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. You can find us. Just look for Next Witness Please. We like to remind you that, you know, although we infuse a little bit of levity in our conversations, we know that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our hope and our goal is that we can increase your understanding of this system, these processes, and the language and what's happening, so that ultimately you'll trust us more. Thank you, folks.
And with that, if you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can always email them directly to me. My email address is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. You can also use that same email address if you have topics that you would like for us to cover. Shoot me an email and we'll add your topic to our list for upcoming episodes. Next Witness Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. With that, Judge Gale and I will be back soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.